Hello and welcome everybody to our Sutra Studies class. Before we get going, let's take a moment to appreciate our handsome community gathered here today. Today I feel fortunate to sit as a member of this kind community in the safety and security of like-minded friends, sharing this present moment with others dedicated to the cultivation of goodness. Today, I'm grateful for the direction and support that this community provides, a community worthy of my time and commitment, a community where my efforts have meaning, purpose, and are appreciated. Today, I'm thankful for this community of awakening, a place to gain the knowledge and skills to improve my life, a family, a home, and a sanctuary for all of us seeking refuge from the storm. And let's remember, as conscientious practitioners, we must recognize our responsibility to the world, to strive to live skillfully while helping others to do the same, to strive to live in balance and harmony with nature and others, to strive to gain mastery over our minds and embody our true benevolent nature, to expand our hearts and minds, transcending our shared human limitation, to not intentionally harm sentient life or our planet, and to maturely accept and embrace the reality of our situation while striving to improve it. Welcome, everyone. This is our SBT Sutra Studies class, and I am your host, Tenzin Tarpa. We are currently examining the Dharmapada, and we will be for quite a while. There is something like 23 or 27 chapters, something like that, and it's going to take us that many weeks to get through it. Today, we'll be covering chapter 7, entitled The Arhat. And I loved this chapter. I hope everybody did their homework. I'm scanning over our group and seeing what instructors we have to do some reading. Darcy, are you okay to do some reading? Yeah, and Nima as well. Yoli, good. Catherine, could you read a couple? Oh, pretty good. All right, that's good. So without further ado, let's get into it. So I'm getting better at juggling all the technology. Let's see how I did today. So, how about if I read the first one? So, anyways, I was mentioning before, I thought this chapter was so inspirational. It just about brought tears to my eyes when they talk about what this arhat is. And maybe even before we start, we define what an arhat is. So, in the Theravada tradition, or the Pali tradition, the arhat is the highest of practitioners. And what's a little confusing is that for a Buddha is an arhat, but a Buddha is a special type of arhat who's able to teach the Dharma, so he's a little bit higher. But in the Theravada tradition, you can't practice your way up to full Buddhahood. The highest you go is an arhat, and the arhat escapes rebirth according to traditional Buddhism, and they're amazing, wonderful practitioners. In a lot of ways, it's the same as in the Mahayana, you have the Bodhisattva. Now, there are some differences between the two, but the arhat is the highest practitioner in Theravada. The Bodhisattva is the highest practitioner in Mahayana. The only difference is the Bodhisattva is supposedly going to be a Buddha within the next few lifetimes, so he's on his way to full Buddhahood, if you believe any of that stuff. But generally, we can just think about the Arhat and Bodhisattva as just being just amazing practitioners, okay? Those who have reached Nirvana, who have perfected the path, all that good stuff that we talk about. And here throughout this chapter, it's going to go into great detail of exactly what the arhat is. So how about if I read the first one, which is 1991. The arhat wandering is at an end. He is free from sorrow, completely free. Sorrow no longer exists for one who has cut all bounds. bonds. The next one. The Arhat dwells in mindfulness. He does not need a home. Like a goose flying away from a pond, he leaves behind place after place. Catherine, would you like to read this one? We found that Buddha Rakita uses a lot of big words, so I always have my smartest friends read these. You're a doctor, so you should be able to handle. 90 and 91, please.
The fever of passion exists not for him who has completed the journey, who is sorrowless and wholly set free and has broken all ties. The mindful one exert themselves. They are not attached to any home. Like swans that abandon the lake, they leave home after home behind.
Oh, that's lovely. And Yoli, would you like to read this one, 91 and 92?
For someone at the journey's end, freed of sorrow, liberated in all ways, released from all bonds, no fever exists. The mindful apply themselves. They don't amuse themselves in any abode. Like swans flying from a lake, they abandon home after home.
Oh, thank you. And so in this first verse, we have this idea of passion, of fever. What is this one? This one talked about his wanderings at an end. Buddha Rakita, I think, talks about fever of passion. And so what are we talking about when we're talking about this fever and this passion? They're not talking here about passion like the passion to practice Dharma or the passion to help others or even simple passions like poetry or artwork. Here in Buddhism, when they refer to passion, they're talking about a negative aspect of passion. They're talking about that uncontrolled mind that desires and wants and just grasps at everything, doesn't think of the consequences, just wants, right? So now you can see why they call it a fever, right? This is someone who's hungry for sensual pleasure, who desires it, has a deep, deep thirst of it. So when we talk about passion in Buddhism, almost always it's used in its negative context. But with that said, like we often say that all qualities are spectrums. Of course, passion has a virtuous side to it. You can be passionate in your Dharma studies. And you know, they practice mindfulness and they don't need an abode, going home to home. I don't know who that sounds like, but it sounds like somebody I know. So anyways, Darcy, would you like to read 92 and 93?
The Arhat does not need possessions. He gives everything away. His sphere of action is wide open and unmarked, completely free. Like the path of a bird across the sky, his way is hard to trace. The Arhat has destroyed all remnants of the fetters. He is not interested in food or drink. His sphere of action is wide open and unmarked, completely free. Like the path of a bird across the sky, his way is hard to trace.
Oh, that's so pretty. Yoli, would you like to read 92 and 93?
Those who do not accumulate and are wise regarding food, whose object is the void, the unconditioned freedom, their track cannot be traced like that of birds in the air. He who cankers are destroyed, and who is not attached to food, whose object is the void, the unconditioned freedom, his path cannot be traced like that of birds in the air.
Oh, that's pretty. Catherine, would you like to read 92 and 93?
Like the path of birds in the sky, it is hard to trace the path of those who have destroyed their toxins, who are unattached to food. Can't see the next one, Tucker.
Are you here on 92?
Oh, sorry. Like the path of birds in the sky, it is hard to trace the path of those who do not hoard, who are judicious with their food and whose field is the freedom of emptiness and signlessness. Like the path of birds in the sky, it is hard to trace the path of those who have destroyed their toxins, who are unattached to food.
Okay, so we have a couple.
There's a bit more. And whose field is the freedom of emptiness and signlessness.
Oh, it's so pretty. So we got a couple of things here we want to talk about. And I'd like to mention that if anybody has comments, you can raise your hand. Miss Catherine can let me know who has questions. You can also type things in the chat window. And if she can, Miss Catherine can keep an eye on that. But with that said, I'll just kind of go on. So I'm just looking at these. So we have a couple things. We talk about the Arha being possessionless, right? He gives everything away, including big red waterproof giant red coats that people buy him. Catherine wants to buy me a giant military grade coat. His spheres of action is wide open and unmarked. How beautiful is that? Completely free, like a bird crossing the sky. And then we talk about here, he has destroyed all feathers. So let's take a second and understand what fetters are. It sounds like something you get with fries from Applebee's, but it's not. Anyways, the 10 fetters, let's just read them. Number one, attachment to self, and the idea like over-attachment to ourselves, right? Number two, the attachment to doubt and uncertainty. Number three, attachment to rites, rituals, precepts, and practices. Number four, sensual desire. Five, ill will. Six, lust for material existence. Seven, lust for immaterial existence. Eight, conceit. Nine, restlessness. And 10, ignorance. Now, first of all, the 10 fetters are something that I think I've only read this in the Theravada tradition. I'm sure it's there in both the Chinese and Tibetan, but they're not really taught. I think the Tibetans don't teach it because of number three, not being attached to rites and rituals, which they love their rites and rituals. But nevertheless, these are quite interesting. So they talk about the five higher and lower of these. But this isn't a very clear subject, because I've seen the three fetters, I've seen the eight fetters, I've seen the 10 fetters. So there is a little bit of a discrepancy of exactly what they are. Some also assert that ignorance itself is made up of the 10 fetters, even including that ignorance is one of them. In Tibetan Buddhism, as we look at afflictions and limitations, everything ends and begins with ignorance. That is the beginning point. That is the major affliction, and that's the cause of all other afflictions. But the Theravada assert that ignorance itself is made up of things, and often they'll say the 10 fetters make up our general ignorance. So anyways, so the first one, attachment to self, is just over-attachment to yourself as this substantial permanent entity, right? Instead of the ethereal being that Buddhism posits how we exist. Doubt and uncertainty isn't the normal kind of scrutinizing that a good practitioner does in the studies. Here we're talking about after you've really got into your teachings and you've taken vows and everything, some people still have this nagging doubt and uncertainty even when they're advanced practitioners. Am I on the right path, and do I have this? It's kind of this habitual thing that's there. Also, this is doubt and uncertainty into the power and the wisdom of the Buddha himself. Number three, attachment to rites, rituals, precepts, and practices. Now, remember, when we say attachment, this is over-attachment to these things, right? So for a lot of us that have taken precepts, we think, well, precepts are one of the biggest parts of our practice. And yet, to be overly attached to them and follow them as like their concrete rules and just spending too much mental energy on this can also be detrimental. Remember that our precepts our training. And the idea, just like if you were learning piano, you learn your scales and you're trained through all of that. But when you perform, you let go of all of that and you perform. So again, when we talk about attachment in Buddhism, it's always related to over-attachment, right? Number four, sensual desires, and that's desire of the senses. Number five, and this is again over-attachment to sensual desire. Five, ill will, being nasty to people. Six, lust for material existence. And seven is lust for immaterial existence. In traditional Buddhism, there's different realms of existence asserted. And some of those realms are a physical existent body like we are as human beings. But for high practitioners that can reach these higher levels of non-form meditations, tradition says that they can be reborn into a non-material existence where they exist, but they don't exist with a body as physical as the one we have now. Technically, they say you still have a body. They often call it a wind. And they say the rider always needs a vehicle. The consciousness always has to have a vehicle, and they just call it a wind. It's not a physical body. As a secular Buddhist, I don't pay much attention to this. Who knows? Maybe it's true. Number eight is conceit. And what I liked so much about this, they usually use the word pride. And I always had a problem with pride because there's so many virtuous prides. I'm proud of all of you guys. We're proud of our kids when they do well at school. We're proud of ourselves for making good decisions and doing the right thing. It's a beautiful level of pride. And then I always had to give this big speech about, well, what non-virtuous pride is. And all of a sudden I started I looked through a few versions of this and I found this word conceit. And in Buddhism, this is really what they're talking about instead of the word pride. I think conceit is a much better word. And so conceit, there really is, I don't think there's any virtuous aspect that can be there of conceit. This is being really proud of yourself in a negative way. Number nine is restlessness. And this is not being able to settle our mind through our meditation and other things. So of course we always have that dichotomy of restlessness and laxity. We're always going back and forth, right? And lastly, ignorance itself. And what are we ignorant of? You could talk about all of these various aspects of the feathers. Most importantly, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, ignorance, the most important aspect is not understanding the true nature of self, right? The first one. Those are almost synonymous. I'll be posting this for everybody after the class. So I hope that was helpful to everybody. We kind of get it out of the way. And with that said, let's get back. I'm just trying to cover some of the vocabulary. So those are the fetters. And what was interesting is that they keep talking about being moderate in food and drink. And I don't know who put that in there, but I just don't agree with that one bit. This is just one more example of people twisting the Buddha's words. Of course, I'm teasing because I'm fat. But you know what's interesting? In Tibetan Buddhism and all my studies, they don't seem to talk about this at all. In fact, reading the Dhammapada this week, I started to really realize how much the Buddha had to say about food. Do you notice he talks about sensual pleasures often. Pleasure of the senses, which is what? Music and art and whatever our senses, right? Fine clothing, the feeling of it on your skin. But he never talks about those individually. But he does talk about food quite a bit. So I'm going to have to step up and make that a stronger part of my practice. So I was really interested in that. just a quick look through these and see. The next thing we're going to talk about is this idea of signlessness. Okay. Those who do not hoard. So monastics aren't permitted to hoard. Catherine. She keeps trying to fill up my bags with stuff. I'm just teasing, Catherine. But monks aren't permitted to hoard food or anything or so wealth. And so That's what they're talking about here. Who is judicious with food? That's a lovely way to say it, isn't it? Who practices moderation, you know? That means not filling your office drawers with cupcakes and Twinkies and stuff like that, okay? And signlessness. So signlessness is a complicated term. So the idea of emptiness is realizing the true nature of things, right? Emptiness, and we're not going to have a teaching here on emptiness. It's a very complicated subject. For those who want to know more about emptiness, we have some really good videos on our YouTube channel. But emptiness is just the realization that all things around us are all interdependent. Nothing exists solely on itself. Everything is independent. Everything is made up of everything else. And so signlessness is a little different. Signlessness is when we reach a state of meditation or a state of existence where just all the things in samsara, all these things, our mind just doesn't focus on them anymore, right? We're not drawn to all of these things. Now, that's kind of the lowest level of signlessness. Now, at the highest level of signlessness is the idea of when in meditation, you get so deep in meditation that you're conscious, but your awareness doesn't touch any object. Now, in Buddhism, they always say that consciousness can only exist in relation to an object. They call it yul and yulchen, object and object possessor, means person and thing, sense and thing. The eye cannot see without an object to see. The eye can't hear without a sound, makes sense. And so at a certain point of meditation and existence, you can move beyond that. A better way to talk about this is if you've read the Heart Sutra. And in the Heart Sutra, it talks about an elevated state of existence, whether meditative or non-meditative, where it talks about a state of existence be with no eye, no ear, no nose, no mouth, and meaning this same thing. Again, both of these topics we could do a whole class on, so I'm just going to touch on them right there. So silence is just this incredibly deep level of existence, and emptiness is existing in an understanding of the true nature of reality. Oh, that was a mouthful. And they just talk about destroying all toxins, right? That's the, they call them cankers in Buddha Rakitas. And that sounds more like a disease on your leg or something, but they mean the fetters, right? Okay, I think I covered it all. Oh, beautiful. Let's move on, everybody. That took me a little bit. Darcy, would you like to read 95? Oh, I'm sorry, where am I? 94 and 95, these two.
Senses of the Arhat have been calmed, like well-trained horses quieted by a charioteer. The Arhat has abandoned pride and extinguished the passions so that even the gods wish to be like him.
And the next one?
The Arhat is as firm as the earth's foundations. Firm in his spiritual practice, he is like a blade of tempered steel. Clear and undisturbed as a deep pond, such a being is not bound to the world.
Hey, I want to be like that. Darcy, would you like to read 93 and 94? Are we on 93? One second. No, we're on 94 and 95. I'll try to keep it. Oh, not Darcy. I'm sorry, Yoli.
Okay.
Even the gods hold dear the wise one, whose senses are subdued like horses, well trained by, I thought we did that one. Charioteer.
I think we're on 94 and 95.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Even the gods hold dear the wise one, whose senses are subdued like horses, well trained by a charioteer, whose pride is destroyed and who is free from the cankers. There is free no more worldly existence for the wise one who, like the earth, resents nothing, who is firm as a high pillar and as pure as a deep pool free from mud.
I just want to be free of cankers. That sounds painful. And Miss Catherine, do you want to read these two, 94 and 95?
Even the gods cherish those who are without toxins, who have abandoned conceit, and whose senses are calm, like horses well tamed by a charioteer. For a person who, like the earth, is untroubled, who is well practiced, who is like a pillar of Indra, who is like a lake without mud, there is no more wandering.
Oh, that's lovely. So the examples of the horse and charioteer are throughout the sutras. They're often talking about that. Well, it was something I wanted to talk about. So the arahat is abandoned a conceit, extinguish the passions, right? Oh, they say that the arahat has calmed his mind, right? So that's the opposite of being passionate, according to Buddhism. So again, they're talking about this this afflicted kind of a passion, an intense kind of a passion. And they talk about him being firm and clear, undisturbed as a deep pond. Lovely. And they talk about the pillar of Indra. And in the notes here, it talks about, I guess at the beginning of a town, they would have a big pillar half buried in the ground, meaning that nothing could move it. And the pillar kind of was, you know, it was, it had untouched by the troubles or the benefits of the town itself. It stood alone. So they're using that comparison. Okay, that's lovely. Oh, Darcy, would you like to read 96 and 97?
Quiet is the mind, quiet the body and speech. Completely freed by genuine knowing, such a being is truly at peace. The arhat is without ambition. He knows the uncreated. He has severed the links of embodiment and is free from longing, free from place or position. This is the best of men.
I think sometimes I should tackle the vocabulary right off the bat here. This line, freed from genuine knowing, I'm lost at what that means. The other two texts talk about possessing ultimate knowledge. So completely free of genuine knowing, I've never heard that term before. It could be a mistake, I just don't know. So I'm gonna set that one aside. The uncreated here is talking about nirvana, right? We talk about nirvana being the deathless, and they also will talk about it as being the uncreated. And let's see if I can keep track of my numbers, 96 and 97. Catherine, would you like to read these two?
Calm is his thoughts, calm his speech, and calm his deed, who truly knowing is wholly freed, perfectly tranquil and wise. The man who is without blind faith, who knows the uncreate, who has severed all links, destroyed all causes for karma, good and evil, and thrown out all desires, he truly is the most excellent of men.
That's lovely. And they talk about calmness of thought, speech, and I think of our SPT practice of soft, right? And Yoldi, would you like to read 94? I keep getting my numbers mixed up. Sorry, folks. 96 and 97, yeah.
In mind, speech, and action, and released through right understanding, such a person is fully at peace. The person who has gone beyond faith knows the unmade, has severed the link, destroyed the potential for rebirth, and eliminated clinging, is the ultimate person.
So I think this is by far the clearest version of this. Calm of bodies, of body, speech, and mind, being soft, right? And he does that through right understanding, or what we call right view, understanding the true nature of ourselves and our environment, right? True nature of reality. Such a person is fully at peace. Oh, the closer I get to that, the more peaceful I am. And then we have the person who has gone beyond faith, meaning that he's actually tasted the results of his practice. He's no longer just going by faith. He's experienced it firsthand. And you don't have to be an arhat to have that. I'm sure we all have already done that. Knows the unmade. So they often talk about nirvana being the uncreated and the unmade because of an interesting thing. Buddhism often posits, you know, all things are impermanent. All things are conditional. All things are dependently originated. Or let me put it another way. All things arise from causes. Well, they'll say there is one thing that doesn't. They claim nirvana doesn't arise from causes. Their nirvana somehow has always existed. Maybe in the same way we talk about stillness. That stillness is just like the space in the room, or let's say the space outside your window out here, there was no beginning and there's no end of this space. When the earth is destroyed, that space is still going to be there. So oftentimes they talk about nirvana being like that as well. I don't agree in my own personal view. To me, nirvana and samsara are mental states. Nirvana is when we eradicate through hard work, when we eradicate samsara, meaning we eradicate our afflictions and our limitations, we can gain nirvana. So to me, it's very clear that it's causal. But that's a debate in Buddhism. But that's why they like to call it the unmade. Severed all links. It means severed any links with samsara. There's no more things that are dragging you back to your old neurotic way of looking at the world, right? You're completely freed from samsara. Destroyed the potential for rebirth. You're not going to be reborn again. And clinging, eliminated clinging. This is the ultimate person. Oh, a lot of vocabulary this week to get through. And we have two to read here. And Yoli, would you like to start with this time? 98 on the screen.
Wherever an arahat dwells is a place of delight, be it lake, field or valley, town or forest. Arahants do not seek desire, but delight in freedom from attachment. They find joy in the wilderness where others find no pleasure.
Oh, isn't that great? And I think these are the last two. Yoli, would you like to try these?
I think I already read.
I'm sorry, Darcy, I'm getting everybody's names mixed up.
98, 99.
I got to stop drinking before class. That's a joke for all you that don't know me. Monks don't drink. 98 and 99, please.
Okay. Inspiring indeed is that place where arahats dwell, be it a village, a forest, a vale, or a hill. Inspiring are the forests in which worldlings find no pleasure. There the passionless will rejoice, for they seek no sensual pleasures.
Oh, that's Yoli in her forest.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to join Yoli.
I meant Darcy. Darcy was just saying she loves the forest.
Oh, yes, I love the forest.
I'm going to try to be a little bit more mindful, everyone. My apologies. I'm juggling all the screens over here. Catherine, would you like to read the last one?
Delightful is the place where the arahant dwells. Delightful are forests where the public does not delight. There the passion-free delight, not seeking sensual pleasure.
Oh, isn't that great? Do we have any comments, insights, or questions into today's chapter?
Can I ask something?
Yes, you can.
It's coming across very much that the Arahant is not, you know, is a wanderer and not attached to his home and not attached to, you know, wandering from place to place. It doesn't speak to us, what are we called? Householders.
Lay people.
And lay people. Am I right that in Theravada, a lay person can't be an Arahant? Do you have to be a monk?
That's not correct. According to the Buddha, there's four types of practitioners: monastic men, monastic women, laymen, and laywomen. They can all become arhats. It's just monasticism is considered the ideal lifestyle to obtain it. But you're right about something, that all of the Dhammapada you're going to see has a really slanted version towards monasticism. And so to me, this makes me a bit suspicious of, you know, how much of this is really spoken to the Buddha, by the Buddha, because the Buddha was very clear about the the evenness of these four groups, the equality of these four groups. It seems like in the early sutras that he's trying to make sure everybody sees these groups as equal, as SPT does. And so it seems like quite possibly Buddhaghosa, you know, in the sixth century, really, really gives a bit of a slant to these. He kind of rewrites the whole Theravada school. In fact, Theravada really is more a product of Buddhaghosa, they say, than the Buddha himself, based on the Buddha. But Buddhaghosa is the one that puts a lot of it together. And remember, this is before it's written down anywhere, right? So I think you can interpret this for a lay person in the same way. You could talk about all those same things, but in a lay context, in a lay environment, that, you know, maybe your own mind is the wilderness where you're at peace while all the chaos is going on around you. The arhat can retire to his own mind and not be bothered by all of these things. Though he has a place, he doesn't have this strong attachment to the place, right? Remember, it's not about the things in our lives, it's our relationship to them. There's nothing wrong with owning a house or owning things. It's the level of attachment you have for those things. Now, ideally, for a Buddhist practitioner, you know, these levels of detachment are amazing trainings and amazing practices, but I don't think it matters for the arhat. I think the arhat, whether he's got a family and he's got a house and he's in a city, that mindset is exactly the same as the one that's in the forest. He's freed from samsara. That's the only thing that matters. He's free from his afflictions, his limitation, the cankers. He's putting ointment on all his cankers. Yeah. Does that help? Yeah, we don't like that they're picking on the lay so much here.
Kuani has his hand up.
Kuani.
When we read the sutra stories, many times after they heard the teaching, the people become arhant, they say. So we read or listen to of teachings, but how come that kind of happen?
Yeah, you want your money back? No, there's no doubt about it. And it's a great question. You know, did they embellish those early stories? Because, you know, in the Buddha's days, it sounds like everybody's getting enlightened like popcorn. They're all popping all over the place. And they seem to do it easily. Buddhism says it's because we live in a degraded age, that we, you know, that because that time of life, it was easier to be a Buddha. And some groups, including Pure Land Buddhism, assert that it's impossible to become enlightened now in our denigrated age. So the Pure Land Buddhists, they pray to be born in the Western Buddha field and where they can be enlightened there after death. So kind of they really don't even do much practice. They just recite mantras to be born in heaven because they don't believe that they can be enlightened at all. So my guess, in my own humble opinion, is that they were just embellished upon. You know, it made for good stories, right? When you're sitting around the fire and you're telling stories, they just, they become better and better. And then the other thought is maybe enlightenment itself has been embellished. And maybe enlightenment is more every day than we think it is. Maybe just our ending of our overreactivity and becoming calmer. So it's a mystery, Kawani. I was sure it was going to be you in this class. I had my money on you. See your screen light up. Ah, he did it. Yeah, and I taught it, and I'm not there yet, so it's not just you. What about me? I've been at this for ages. But I'm getting closer. I'm very happy with my progress, to be honest with you. I see a little bit of myself in some of those verses that we talked about today. Unfortunately, not the ones about food, you know. Yeah. Anybody else have any insights, questions? Okay, how about we get to our final conclusion, I guess we're calling it. So what I try to do is kind of wrap up what we've studied. And I guess I'm trying to put it in different language to make some of them almost adding a fourth version of what they are. So if it's helpful at all. And please let me know if you have any comments on them. So reading through these from 90 to 99. So we define the arhat here as one whose wandering is at an end. That's kind of a nice thought, huh? He's home, right? Who has completed the journey, who is passionless, who is liberated in all ways, who has cut all bonds to samsara, free of sorrow, completely free. I'm buying into that. What do you think, Kawani? That sounds pretty good. The next one is the arhat dwells in mindfulness and does not need a home. Here, mindfulness, I would say that they're talking about samadhi. So that's going to be mindfulness, stillness, emptiness, nirvana. But what they're saying here is that he's so content in his mind, he doesn't need much else. Next, the arhat does not need possessions and gives everything away. They do not hoard and is moderate with food. They have the freedom of emptiness and signlessness. Again, that's a difficult thing to explain shortly. Having no attributes or signs that awareness can focus on. 93, the arhat is freed from the 10 fetters, who abides in emptiness and the unconditioned is another lovely way to talk about nirvana and these higher states. The arhat has tamed their senses, abandoned conceit, and extinguished passions. The arhat, well-practiced and untroubled, is resolute, stable, unperturbable. Unperturbed means you can't get angry. They often talked about the Buddha as being unperturbable, if that's really a word. Maybe I made that word up. The arhat, well-practiced and untroubled, is resolute, stable, and unperturbable. That's great. Yes, do you have a question, comment? Okay. The arhat, calm in mind, speech, and action, is liberated through right view. We talked about that in our Skillful Living teaching series, which will be starting again in January, that what liberates us is right view, having the right understanding of our true nature and the true nature of reality. The arhat has gone beyond faith, has severed all bonds of samsara, and directly knows the unconditioned, that would be a nirvana, uncreated and uncaused, the state of nirvana. Delightful is the place where the arhat dwells. I like that one. And I would say that when I've met great teachers, it is delightful in their space. So I say that one's definitely factual. And lastly, the arhat is non-attached and passionless and seeks no sensual pleasure and dwells happily in the forest. I'm not a forest guy. I'm a city guy. I hope I can still abide in peace in my city. Okay, and in closing, remember that the sutra teachings are meant as practice instructions. So in order to get the greatest benefit, we need to engage fully with them, utilizing the three great objectives of study, contemplation, and meditation, which means we read about it like today. Now, when you get done with class, you pour yourself a cup of tea, you sit in a chair, and you think, now what about that? And you think about it, you ponder it. Then you take it to the cushion and insight meditation, and you deepen your understanding. Your work this week is discover how these teachings apply to your daily life, transforming them from words on a page into living Dharma. Next week, we'll be moving on to chapter 8 of the Dharmapada, entitled Thousands. So, without further ado, any questions, comments, insights? Last chance. Okay, let's end with our altruistic prayer. May all be healthy, may all be prosperous, may all be well, may all be present, free of past regret and future worry. May all abide in constant appreciation, which is the source of great joy and contentment. May all realize their true nature and the true nature of reality, which is awakening. And our last prayer that resonates with a lot of what we studied today, didn't it? Yeah. Well, what did you guys think of this chapter? Was it inspiring to you folks? To me, it painted such a beautiful picture of what could be, right? David?
I find this the most difficult chapter of any chapter that there's been so far, for two reasons. One, I'm not going to be enlightened in this lifetime as described here. And I don't believe in other lifetimes. It just seems to set a target so far beyond my experience. And that's not what you should have for a target. It should be conceivable. And the other thing is you had to rephrase a lot of it. I think you've kind of covered that in your description of Buddha Ghosha. I mean, you had to keep saying things like, well, when they say passion, they don't really mean passion, they mean over passion. And when they say attachment, they don't really mean attachment, they mean over attachment. And a lot of it needed to be rephrased to really not seem extreme to me. That said, there were some beautiful bits in it, but it was easily the most difficult chapter I've had so far.
I agree with everything you said. And in fact, what you said is some of the reasons why we started SPT, because of a lot of this extreme language and things that clearly, I don't think is accurate and in not ways I want to practice, right? The first thing you mentioned that I wanted to correct, and of course, this is my own belief and SPT belief, that we don't see enlightenment and we don't see nirvana and samsara as two dichotomy states. We believe in that all of these things exist in a scale, right? And I cannot talk today. What are the words I'm trying to say? But they all exist. And step by step, we work our way to awakening. Whether there's some giant enlightenment with a capital E waiting for us down the road, the scriptures talk about it, I don't know. But I do know that our path is incremental. I have been awakening ever since I started my path, and I increasingly move closer and closer to what they're talking about in that arhat chapter. Many of the things in there I can mildly start to identify with, and I can see what that would be like or what that mindset is. So for SBT, we see an incremental path. You and we don't use the word enlightenment. We talk about awakening, the verb. We are all awakening. I see it among all of you that have been working with us. I see you all awakening as you learn, as you meditate. It's a, in fact, some of the longer practitioners here, it's amazing the transformation that some people have made, where they were just so shy when they first came on with so many troubles, and now they're really shining. So that's the way SBT looks at it. You are more than welcome to join us in that view. And so it's not an ultimate view. It's a spectrum, right? We believe in a spectrum of awakening. And so, and I really believe at focusing on practice, right? That we, the real practice is looking down at the path and taking step by step. Once in a while, we got to look up and see where we're going. And that's what this chapter does. This chapter tells us the direction, and we look up, and we say, oh, way down there you want to go, right? But the work is day to day, step by step. That's the work. Every day becoming a little smarter, a little kinder. Now, if you do the day's work, you do your prayers, you say your vows, whatever it is, the future we don't know. But whatever you're going to be is guaranteed. Whatever level of enlightenment or awakening awaits you, guaranteed if you just do your work every day. So that's how we should be looking at it, right? Get your meditations and say your prayers. Come to some classes and just relax. And, you know, whatever will be, will be. There's no guarantee that any of us will be anything at some point. We can, that's the only thing we can really do, right? Unless you believe in magic and you think that if you meet just the right lama, it might, he might bonk you on the head or give you that one secret tantric initiation that nobody else knows about, or I mail you a Harry Potter wand and you can use it on yourself and enlighten yourself, whatever. So, you know, we all have different belief systems. Darcy?
I've been taking it. Like, how am I incorporating this in my day-to-day life? And how am I how have I changed the way that I treat others? Or, like, the major thing was being able to forgive my daughter-in-law, you know, and to see that she has problems that she doesn't know how to deal with, and she'll get there eventually, you know.
And so the quality of your life.
Exactly. That's, and to me, it's an awakening, because I have been just, I mean, to be frank, I've been pissed off for a long time, and I'm so calm, and I can focus my mind, and it's like a huge change since last May. So that's how I look at it.
Yeah, and for me, my path has been a whole bunch of aha moments, just little ones. You know, every couple of days, you go, oh, they mean this, and oh, they mean that. I haven't had that big one. Maybe it's out there waiting. I'll let you know if it hits me. But I don't see that happening. I see it being incremental. And just by putting some diligent effort in, I can improve my life and live a much better life. Oh, Miss Catherine.
See, my experience is that it's incremental, but it kind of does this.
Wobble, yeah.
So that if I look at me a year ago, I'm probably slightly more awakened than I am now. But you look at me tomorrow or the next week and I may not be. So it's like that for me, I think. But the general
trend, like the old saying. The old saying, progress is never a straight line.
Sometimes it goes right down.
Two steps forward, one step back. Mine too. Join the club. We do the best we can, right? Hey, that's great. Fun class. Hey, thanks everybody for joining me. Okay, guess what? Tomorrow, class 10, week 10 of our 10-week meditation program. We're going to be learning the peak of peaks of meditation. We're going to be doing union with mindfulness meditation, one of my personal favorites. And we have, but it's not just our last class tomorrow. We're going to be practicing all week. We have makeup classes. We have daily meditation. So actually the program won't be over until the following week. And when I get around to writing all the certificates and getting all the stuff out to everybody. But it's going to be a great class. So we'll be beginning tomorrow Sunday, we'll be beginning daily meditation with our loving kindness meditation. And then we'll do our 10-week meditation program. So should be an awesome Sunday. And SBT version. What do you mean, Darcy?
That was back when we were talking and David was talking about how we have to reinterpret what was said even back, you know, back then. And it seems like having a more reinterpreting it to have a more common sense and secular.
Yeah. And we don't have to feel guilty about it because people have been reinterpreting the Buddhist teaching since he died. It's in 18 Hinayana schools appear after he dies. Everybody's been interpreting his, every tradition is an interpretation. So we can't let anybody tell us we're not allowed to. They all did. And the secret is teachers teach people how to use the Buddha's teaching skillfully. Right? That's what we do. And that's what we're doing here at SBT. Awesome. Thanks for joining me, friends. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for running tech support, Catherine. You're awesome.
No problems. See you soon.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.